And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight is going to be a very interesting show. I'm very much looking forward to it. I've been doing the exercises for the past month now, and I've been enjoying it. So I welcome David Berselli, the author of The Revolutionary Trauma Release Process, Transcend Your Toughest Times. So welcome, David.
Thank you.
Now, this is a very unique book. I mean, it's very different from anything I've, you know, read, and certainly trauma, which we'll get into in great depth, has been a challenge that most people say, you know, if you don't get it, if you don't work through it in the very beginning, you're kind of stuck with it. Or, and as we all know, when we're doing our deeper inner work, that can often be the case where, you know, we, our patterns are repeated and we learn a lot of different things, but it, you know, a lot of the times it kind of gets stuck in our muscle memory as well as our mental memory. And we, you know, it becomes a little bit of a challenge. So you've given us this really interesting and fascinating process to go through that's pretty easy. And, I think allows us to work through this. And we'll talk about, you know, I guess what I experienced. But while we start, why don't we talk about, you know, how did you get to where you are now? You sort of talked a little bit about it in your book, but, you know, what has been your journey and why has, you know, this trauma release process, or why has this become your passion?
Well, essentially what happened to me is I ended up moving to the Middle East, and I was living there, and I was living in several African countries working for a nonprofit organization, and a number of the countries I was living in were experiencing war or political violence. As a result of those experiences, I realized something was happening to me. I didn't realize I was being traumatized at the time, but it was happening to me, and it was changing the way I think, my belief system, and it was changing the way I feel inside my body. And I didn't understand all of that, but as I began to experience this, I was talking to other people who were also living in these countries, and they were also having experiences inside themselves which they couldn't understand or define or explain what was going on. So I began to explore what was living at war, which is basically a very primitive response for humans, because it's sort of us living at the verge of life and death all the time, every day. And I wanted to know, what effect does that have on the human being? So I began to study myself and the others I was with, and I began to sort of dissect what was happening in our bodies, what was happening in the way we think, and what was happening in our belief systems. And I began to see that there were patterns in all of these things. And once I saw there were patterns, I then asked myself, well, how would we undo those patterns once they're created by war? So as an example, in the body, what I realized was that a lot of us were getting lower back pains, we were getting chronic tension patterns in our body, and we were having experiences that we didn't exactly understand why our bodies were responding in certain ways. And that's what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, experiences that I had from trauma, but they continued long after the traumatic event was over. So I began to look at all of this, and then once I began to dissect it, I developed a method in which human beings can, by themselves, actually begin to recover from traumatic experiences simply by using their own bodies, because the body is what went through the traumatic experience in the first place, and the body should be able to restore itself back to health. And so that's how I ended up designing these exercises.
Hmm. So you start the book with, you know, talking about how traumatic life is, because, you know, I think we just don't realize how much of a state of stress or anxiety we're in all the time. And whether it's, you know, us experiencing childbirth, whether it's, you know, children and the stress that having children has on our lives, the economic times for sure is, you know, something that's causing a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety right now. And, you know, part of the problem is that we resist the experiences.
Yeah. Well, what I want to do, or what I've been trying to do, is actually normalize the word trauma for people. Because when people hear it, they think, well, I'm not sure I've had trauma in my life. And we're afraid of that word. And what I'm trying to help people recognize is that every person has some degree of a traumatic event in their lives. And that could be, just like you said, from early childhood. You could have had parents that were just angry, or they were having financial difficulties. There was constantly tension in the family. You could have had dysfunctional behaviors like an alcoholic parent. You could have lived in inner city violence. All of these different things, and now even today, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, all those things cause traumatic experiences in people's lives. And what I'm trying to get us to recognize is that it's actually quite common for people to have traumatic experiences. And instead of trying to push them away or pretend they didn't happen to us, if we learn to normalize that and recognize, yes, I've had traumatic experiences in my life, I've had severe stress, that we then no longer become afraid of those experiences, and we learn to look at them openly and then, in a sense, invite ourselves into healing from those processes.
Mm-hmm.
So try to normalize trauma.
Right. And, you know, you talk about how it's not really the events that cause the damage to our health, but it's how we respond to.
Exactly, right. And each of us will respond differently according to, you know, our early childhood experiences, how many traumas we may have had, how much stress we've lived under, etc. We're all going to respond differently, but all of us have the ability to heal from that response or that traumatic event. And that's what I try to bring out in my book.
Mm-hmm. Which comes out nice and clear. You know, it's kind of about aligning ourselves with what is, and a lot of the times we're, like we said, you know, we're very resistant. Fighting causes suffering on ourselves and our emotion, and we, you know, it damages ourselves and our relationships. And, you know, you also talk about, you know, the differences between stress and anxiety. Why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, what is it that we, how do we stop ourselves from, you know, creating the suffering?
Well, it's a very difficult process, because when we're talking about stress and anxiety, stress, you know, I'm living under stress every day, just driving to work as an example, being on freeways where people could be angry or there could be a lot of traffic. My boss gets mad, I'm under a deadline, those sorts of things. All of those are stressful events, and so we live in those. But what we don't recognize is that our body is constantly taking on this pattern of stress as a way to try to survive and endure the events. And then what happens is we have anxiety. Anxiety is about, well, I didn't get my work done yesterday. My boss is going to be mad at me tomorrow, and I'm under a deadline, or my children have got, you know, medical bills, and I don't have enough money to pay them. So now we live under anxiety, and it's creating the same patterns in our body. So stress and anxiety create very chronic tension patterns, which we know medically create secondary and tertiary medical problems. So I could get ulcers from them. I could have all types of gastrointestinal problems, lower back pains, etc. All of that from experiences of what we live every day as stress and anxiety. And if we're going to live lifestyles like that, then we need to put into our lives behaviors that help to reduce those stressful and anxiety producing problems in the body. And that's what these exercises do. You can actually reduce these exercises down to a 15-minute routine and actually just really begin to eliminate or reduce the stress and anxiety levels in the body, which are located in the muscle patterns of the body, at the end of the day, and actually restore yourself back to a pretty healthy position.
Now, you talk about how trauma is very individual in nature, that we all go, you know, one person may experience a car accident as traumatic, somebody else may not experience as traumatic, and it really depends on, you know, who we are and how we judge it. But that, you know, often, you know, trauma or the reaction to the trauma is judged as a weakness, yet it's very instinctual, and it's actually a positive response.
Well, it's true. The reactions that we have during traumatic or stressful events are completely normal. For each one of those, they may be different, but whatever reaction we're having is absolutely normal to the body, normal to the person. The difficulty is that we then interpret that reaction as a weakness. So if I start to tremor, as an example, which is what these exercises are about, tremoring, a response in the body which is natural. If I get anxious, you might feel your legs begin to shake, or your hand starts to shake, or your jaw begins to quiver. We actually have pathologized those experiences as showing signs of weakness or vulnerability or inability to hold up to the stressful situation or fear. And what I realized was happening, and I got this from living in war because it was an extreme example of stress and anxiety, is that everybody had those experiences of tremoring. And then when I realized everyone was having them, I thought this must be more normal rather than abnormal. And then I began to explore what those tremors were about, and I realized that all mammals have a tremoring response during anxiety or stress. And what that tremoring response does is actually help restore the body back into a calm state. So it's actually reducing the stress and anxiety rather than it's an example of some type of negative response to the stressful or anxiety situation.
Hmm. Yeah, we try to control it often because we do judge it as a weakness.
Right, exactly.
Hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. So we also have learned to suck it up, as you say, in the book. And that, you know, that has to do with being submissive and withdrawing.
Yes, exactly. Well, this whole thing about sucking it up is, it's one of those things where we say, well, pull yourself up by the bootstraps and get on with life. It's okay. It happens to everybody. You have to start living life and get over it. Partially that is true in the sense that we want to go through this process and heal it so we can move on with life. But it's not about denying that it happened. It's about feeling the pain and the heartbreak and the sadness and sometimes the anger that it did happen. But by processing it and going through it is when we move on. If you simply hold it in, contract against it, and then try to move on before it's time for the resolution to occur, what you'll do is carry it with you through the rest of your life. And that's generally what we've been taught in society. We haven't been taught to process it, breathe through it, let yourself deal with it, and then move on. We've been taught basically to hold it in, suck it up, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and move on. And then what we ended up doing was carrying it through the rest of our lives, only for it to surface or resurface again years later as an unresolved issue inside of ourselves.
Yeah. And especially during times where, you know, something triggers it that, you know, we're not even expecting, and it seems like it's coming out, you know, out of left corner or, you know, completely out of the blue, that we're not even thinking that this response happens and it creates, you know, a breakdown or it creates.
Right. What usually happens is what triggers it is some type of relationship issue. And so then people confuse the current relationship they're having with psycho-emotional issues that are resurfacing from 10 years ago in a prior relationship. And then they think that this relationship is the one that's going bad, and they don't realize that it's simply recalling for them situations in the past around the relationship. So it can be very, very damaging to present-day relationships, even though it may have nothing to do with it. And that's what I think is so sad about it. Unhealed trauma will resurface in some way and can potentially damage the new relationships you're trying to establish.
Right. And you said one of the most common responses to trauma is depression.
Yeah, that's very common because depression, if you think of it this way, it's about repressing something inside yourself. So you have anger as an example, and you hold it in, and you try not to let people see you're angry, and you don't want to express anger because socially that's not an acceptable expression to us. And so you really manage to lock it inside yourself. But to hold that in means that you have to somehow depress emotions. And so you can't just depress one of them. You end up depressing all of them. And so people end up going into depression because they have unresolved emotions that are really trying to surface, but they're desperately trying to hold them inside. And to do that, you basically have to deaden the body or deaden your emotional state, which is what depression is about.
Mm-hmm. And so we're not living, we're not being authentic, we're just sleepwalking through life.
Basically, that's it. And we'll take medications to support that behavior pattern, to support not feeling life. And then that's the way we depress the emotion inside of ourselves. And it's damaging because any depressed emotions like that will cause you to live the rest of your emotional state with other people that you're trying to build intimacy with, and you'll never be able to achieve it because you're constantly holding back emotion.
Yeah. And depression seems to be a pretty wide problem in our society.
It's very, very commonplace. And it's commonplace because people haven't resolved usually traumatic or stressful events in their lives, and they're still repressing them. And so in order to continue to repress it, they will end up taking some type of medication. That's one of the most common medications we take in our culture is antidepressants to try to get us out of depressive states.
Mm-hmm. Which can make you suicidal instead, right?
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah. Well, one of the side effects for many antidepressants is suicide ideation.
Hmm. So one of your, I guess, aha moments was when you were in Ethiopia and you said you had this window opening where, you know, they had this ritual of coffee in the mornings.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little
bit. Yeah, I was working with people who were survivors from the Ethiopian and Eritrean war. And what I was doing was trying to realize how did they have in their culture ways of addressing severe trauma like they were experiencing it. And so I began to observe their culture. What I discovered was in the morning they have an amazing ritual where they actually take coffee beans and they actually begin by roasting them in the morning. So it's very fresh coffee. But they roast the beans, and then they pound the beans into powder, then they make the coffee. So it takes about an hour or two to actually have a cup of coffee. But during that time, it was astounding because everyone sitting around, and this would be men and women actually, would talk about what happened the day before. They were sort of like reminiscing or filling each other in on things. And what they were doing was actually a psychotherapy session. They were saying, you know, so-and-so in the next hut, you know, or over in the next village just found out that his daughter was safe, and they were very happy, and she's going to be here in 2 days. And then did you hear about so-and-so's village that was bombed, and they lost 6 people, and they lost 2 out of their family? And they actually processed all of this event while they were making the coffee, so that it was actually common for them to laugh and joke or to cry or to get angry. But through that whole process, it was nothing different than what we call a support group here in this country. But they had embedded it right into a cultural pattern. And so they were actually doing psychotherapy with themselves as a family and a community just by talking to one another about the circumstances they were living through.
And that's one thing we don't do enough.
Well, here in this society, what we generally have done, even if a family goes through trauma, oftentimes what we'll do is send each of the children to therapy, or one or both of the parents may go to a therapist, but they end up going individually. So we've become this isolated society, even within our family, where we don't sit down and talk about these situations as family. We actually send them outside of the family environment to go to therapeutic services to talk about it there, whereas we actually should be bringing the trauma, much like the Ethiopians did, right into the community or right into the family dynamics and talk about and process it right from within the home itself. And it was extremely therapeutic for them.
Mm-hmm.
See, trauma will either fracture the family dynamics or make it stronger. Mm. It will fracture it if you don't deal with the trauma. If you bring the trauma right into the family and you begin to talk about it as a family dynamics and experience, and people open up to their emotions and share these, you can actually deepen the family relationships from that type of experience rather than allowing the trauma itself to fracture the relationships in the family.
Wow. Yeah, I could see where that would be empowering, which is what you say the most effective therapist empowers us to take recovery into our own hands.
Yeah, that's what I think we're lacking, because here's an example. Let's just use Hurricane Katrina as an example.
Mm.
Thousands of families obviously were affected by this, and many traumatized by it. But how many of them sat down and processed the pain of this and the sadness as a family group, in a way of being cohesive? Did they sit down as a whole community and talk about this? We went in and we provided them with counseling services, et cetera, but we didn't set up a dynamics where they could heal themselves and perpetuate their own healing process long after the therapists are gone. And that's what we need to do, is start instituting right within the family or community dynamics a process where they can actually begin healing themselves without needing the guidance of a professional counselor or therapist.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about how the brain processes trauma. It's associated with triggering memories, but they're fragmented, and then it creates chronic pain or illness and all
this. Well, what will happen in the brain is that when it experiences a traumatic event, it, in a sense, begins to isolate that event as a particular type of neurological pattern in the brain, different from everyday memories. And so it isolates that event. Now, it does that for the purpose of us surviving the traumatic event. It's just too overwhelming for us emotionally. So it's sort of like we store it in a certain part of the brain until we can process it later, because trying to process the emotions at the moment that the event is happening is too overwhelming. So the brain kind of stores it in a special place. Then what we're supposed to do afterwards is go back to that place and begin to let the pieces of that memory and that experience and the emotions as well start to come out little by little and process it. But when those emotions come back out, again, they feel so overwhelming that we try to control them or repress them again, because we say, I don't want to go through this. I've been through it once. I don't want to go through it again. So actually preventing the brain from doing what it is naturally trying to do, which is reenact this event for the purpose of now moving it into its normal everyday memory so that it can process it in a more healthy way. And eventually what will happen is it will get stored in the part of the brain where all the rest of the memories of our history of our lives have been stored, and no longer has that tremendous, overwhelming emotional connection to it. So you can tell the story as a historical event in your past, but it's no longer affecting the way you live in your present moment. And so that's what the brain tries to do. It tries to actually help and save us during the traumatic event by storing it in a special way, but then it expects us to go back to that and actually process it so that it can then move it into a natural memory for itself. But we don't like it, so we try to continue to repress those thoughts or those events.
Yeah, we certainly are a society that is afraid of the pain that, you know, that we naturally go through. We certainly try to repress every one of the more negative emotions. And I think there are people out there, you know, that actually suggest that that's what we should be doing. We should be detaching from it. And, you know, I think there's a lot of problems that are caused as a result of that.
Well, we've become a society of not wanting pain. Pain has been identified as being a bad thing. So everything from aspirins to more severe medications are all about, let's reduce pain, let's not be uncomfortable. And yet life is full of uncomfortable situations, and we all know it. I think it's healthier for us to learn how to live and process uncomfortable situations so that we're not constantly trying to run from them, or we're not trying to medicate ourselves from them. If you learn to live that pain and anxiety is a natural part of living on this planet, you no longer begin to fear it and run away from it. And you begin to look at it and say, wow, there's something I can learn from the experience. If I let myself experience it deep enough, I can actually learn something at a very deep level about myself or about life. So trying to refuse to learn about these situations by experiencing them really cuts us off from living life. And again, that's what goes back to depression or constantly using medications that prevent us from feeling those unpleasant experiences that we all have.
Mm-hmm. And I liked how you talked about, you know, prolonged stress causes an exhaustion of your adrenal glands. And I know a lot of people talk about the adrenal glands, at least in the alternative medical field, but I don't know that a lot talk about it in, you know, the Western health, but that, you know, that affects our immune system. And that's, you know, what causes a lot of different illnesses, whether it's from anxiety to depression to blood pressure to different types of cancer.
Yeah, our immune system is actually, although very strong and resilient, is also quite fragile in some ways. When we stay or live in continued stress and anxiety for prolonged periods, we're actually burning out the adrenal glands because we're requiring them to stay running 24 hours a day. This is what we're finding with soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. They live basically in a state of alert, high alert, for a year. And then they come back here, and then they have all types of secondary health problems. And that's because their adrenal glands are actually wearing down. They're burning themselves out. And there's so much adrenaline and cortisol in the system that it's causing other chemical imbalances to happen in the body, which then create all these secondary illnesses that they have. So we do live in a culture. You don't have to go to war for this. You can live in a culture where you're going to stressful situations at work every day of your life, and then you come home and you have a stressful family environment, you will actually burn out your adrenal glands and begin creating secondary illnesses as a result of it. And by and large, our culture lives in that type of circumstance.
Yeah. And you said that when the adrenaline and the cortisol, it actually reduces the serotonin in our body?
Right, right. When adrenaline is introduced in very high levels, cortisol levels serotonin levels reduce, because serotonin is that feel-good drug. Mm-hmm. Well, when the body's creating chemicals that are concerned about surviving danger, which is what stress and anxiety would be about, it reduces that feel-good drug. And antidepressants are precisely that. It's putting serotonin back into the body again to try to make the person feel good again. Well, we could naturally reintroduce serotonin if we reduce stress levels in the body. Once you reduce the adrenaline and cortisol, the serotonin levels will automatically begin to rise.
Hmm. So talk about this instant on button that seems to be getting stuck, which is what we're talking about, really, which is what's happening. But, you know, when you talk about the reptilian brain, and I've recently been introduced to what the reptilian brain can do for us, but you know, it kind of is the one that, you know, has this fight, flee, or freeze response, and this is what's kind of triggering all of this.
Right. Well, what happens if we're in stress or experiencing anxiety, and the higher the stress or anxiety becomes, the more exaggerated our response will normally be. And basically, the response is this: if I can flee the situation, I'll flee it. That's the flight response. If I can't flee it, I'll fight my way out of it. So that's your fight response. So you have your fight or flight response activated first. If you can't get out of it from either of those responses, you'll have a freeze response, which is basically kind of numbing dissociative response. Mm-hmm. So as an example, if I'm standing in front of my boss and he or she is yelling at me, but I can't get away, I can't run from my boss, I can't fight back in anger because that would jeopardize my job. And so I'll basically freeze or numb myself out. That's how we do this socially. If I learn to live in that state, then what I'm actually doing is learning how to live in some type of traumatized state within myself every day when I go to work, as an example. So I keep repeating the pattern over and over. So I'll end up in a fight, flight, or freeze response, living there most of my life, because I've now embedded in my body and in my brain that every day is potentially danger for me. So every day I must live with a response that's going to protect me from my life or death threat, as an example. And that's what we do. We actually train ourselves to live in those states. And that's why so many people, when they come home from work, have difficulty saying, I can't let go, I can't let down, I can't relax. And so we'll usually medicate in some way, either by using alcohol or other substances. And we do it as a way of trying to turn ourselves off, but our system is actually turned on because we can't turn it off just through using medications. we actually have to turn it off from learning how to reduce that threat within ourselves. And so that's how we end up living most of our lives, in some sort of chronic threat response.
Right. So I'm assuming, you know, learning how to meditate or learning, you know, different breathing exercises would assist us, as well as obviously doing your exercises. But, you know, we really need to, I guess, be more aware of our reactions and our emotional reactions and things that are going on that we're trying to deaden.
Yeah, it's difficult, because once you start deadening feelings, oftentimes you don't even know that you're doing it,
Exactly. Obviously,
because you're sort of anesthetizing yourself to feelings. All of these things like yoga and meditation and breathing exercises, they're all geared around the same thing, to reduce the high levels of anxiety and stress. And once they reduce, can you feel what's going on inside of your body? Now, a lot of people can't do yoga, or they can't concentrate enough to meditate, or they're not calm enough to actually even breathe deeply. And so these exercises that I design, you don't really even have to concentrate on them. You just do them as physical exercises, and they have a powerful effect on the body and the brain by their own nature. So you don't have to try to work to make it happen. You simply end up laying on the floor, allowing it to happen to you, which is very different than having to try to concentrate or breathe correctly. This will do it to the body naturally. And so you just lay there feeling something occurring inside yourself, which is the reduction of the stress and anxiety in the body.
Right. I'm debating whether we want to talk about those now. You know, my experience has been, like, I found them very interesting, and certainly the first few times that I did it, the trembling was really dramatic, and then it eased off, and then it, you know, it comes back at different points, and it's very interesting. I certainly haven't found how to do it for 15 minutes yet. It's been, it's about 45 minutes, I think, when I do it, because the last two exercises themselves are over 30 minutes. But I would love to hear how you can get it down to 15.
Well, what you'll do, this is a perfect example. When you first start doing the exercises, you do the whole routine of the exercises. That helps evoke these tremors in the body. And then when you're laying down on the floor, like you said, the first few times the tremors were very, very strong, and then they started to get milder. Well, that's basically what happens, is that the first few times the tremors are generally strong because they're their first time getting access to being able to release the chronic tension patterns in the body. As they release those patterns, you should see a reduction in the tremor, because now the muscles are more loose and more flexible, and so they don't shake as strongly as they do when you first do the exercise.
Right.
However, that's not to say that you might not now go down into a deeper layer where they once again get very strong, but that's because they're going to another chronic tension pattern that's probably older in the body, and when they release those, then it will get milder as well. The way to reduce it to a 15-minute experience, and you probably could do this now, is if you simply did the last exercise, where you laid on the floor and then you allowed your knees to relax open and picked your pelvis up, you probably get tremoring right away.
Mm-hmm.
Then all you have to do is just lay on the floor and let yourself tremor.
Okay.
Usually at the end of the day, if you do that for about 15 minutes, and I tell people do it while they're watching TV or listening to music or whatever, so they distract themselves because they don't have to concentrate. The body will do it by itself. If you do that for about 15 minutes, you can begin to feel the stress in the body slowly reducing itself. Now, some people will lay there and do it for an hour simply because it feels pleasurable.
Hmm. Yeah, I could see that. I've been doing it in the mornings, which is usually my time of doing it, and I think doing it at night is probably a better option for me, but I forget.
Well, do they cause you to feel energized or relaxed?
A little bit of both, really. I haven't found that. I mean, I think maybe in the beginning, it felt more exhausting because it felt like a lot of stuff was being released.
Right.
And now it's not quite the same, but I do find it relaxing.
Right. Okay, that's great. That's a good example. In the beginning, it felt more tiring because there was a lot being released. That's a very, very common experience for most people because they release so much tension, and then they realize the tired effect is, oh my goodness, I didn't realize how tired my body was from the amount of stress I was holding in the muscle tissue. And so you actually begin to feel that. It's always been in there, but now you began to feel it. And then after that level of stress goes out of the muscle tissue, and now the muscle tissue is more relaxed, that's when you begin to feel some more energy, because now you've got some more flexible muscle. It's not holding on to chronic tension, so there's greater blood flow and fluid movement through the muscle tissue, and you say, wow, I feel a little bit more energized now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, you talk about the emotional pain. It's not just in our head. It seems to etch in our muscles, and that's why you've come up with these exercises. But, you know, you noticed it when it was in response to, I guess, some bombing that was happening. And, you know, you found every one of you would go into a fetal position response.
Well, yeah. What I realized when I was living in war was that this was the most extreme example of what life is like for all of us in some way or another. And so I got to see it in its most obvious form of life or death threat. But what happened was when I was living in a situation where we were being bombed, is that every time a mortar shell or a bomb would hit close to the building we were in, we would all immediately startle ourselves into a fetal position. You know, like if you're sitting on the ground and you cover your head and you pull your knees up into your belly to protect yourself. Well, we happened to be doing this all day long, and what I discovered was all of us did it instinctually as a natural response. We weren't trained how to do it. We didn't know what we were doing. It was just an organic response to us protecting ourselves. And what I realized was is that the body knew exactly how to make this pattern in the muscle tissue. And it was a pattern it was making for a very specific purpose. And it was to protect the human body, mostly protecting the viscera, the belly of the body, from danger, because that's how we stay alive. And when I realized that, I thought, well, there must be very specific muscle patterns that do this, and they must be connected to a certain part of the brain because they're done instinctually, much like blinking our eyes is done, not something we were thinking about doing.
Right.
So I began to study it, and I researched what the muscle pattern in the body was that creates that, and the primary muscle for that is called the psoas muscle, which is located in the pelvis. And I realized the psoas muscle contracts in a very instinctual way to pull us towards a fetal position when we're in danger. And you can watch this even in young children. So let's say you have a 2-year-old child and you yell at the child and you send them to bed or whatever. They will oftentimes go into their bedroom and they'll be crying and they'll curl up naturally into a fetal position because for them their life has been endangered and the body naturally curls up into this protective position because it feels safe. So my exercises were designed at trying to figure out if that's what we do when we feel we're endangered, how can we release that tension pattern so that we can put the body back into a position of safety? And so that's what these exercises do. They basically release the tension pattern in that core set of muscles from the psoas muscle all the way up to the neck that allows the body to restore itself back into a safe and calm position so it comes out of its danger response.
Right. Now, as you were saying that, it makes me think of, you know, while we're in the womb, we're always in a fetal position, which is why it's called a fetal position. And that is our memory of being the safest, I guess, because we are most nurtured and everything's available to us and we're certainly not for want. We're growing and it's all being done naturally and processing. So I guess it's both, really, of the most safe memory we have.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the body repeats that memory anytime it thinks it's in danger. And the more severe the perception of the life or death threat, the more intense it takes on that position of a fetal position for safety purposes. And it makes a lot of sense that it would do that. And so then after the danger is over, the body should, in fact, restore itself back up into an upright position. But the problem is if you live in chronic fear of danger, you're never allowing the body to release that muscle pattern, so it lives in a chronic tension pattern, and that's what creates most of the gastrointestinal problems that we have around anxiety and stress, is that we actually have a chronically held tension pattern that's constricting the gastrointestinal area from an easy flow of fluids going through it. And so what we do is we actually create these problems by the very anatomical position that we learn to live in to protect ourselves from this ongoing, what we perceive to be ongoing threat or danger.
Mm-hmm. And yet, also going back to the trembling that you had talked about, I mean, that seems to be an automatic response as well, even though we try to control it. It seems to be something that we all do, even though it may not be as traumatic event that would cause us to go into the fetal position, but it certainly, I mean, I think we've all had experiences where, you know, we've had that uncontrollable shaking. I can't imagine somebody not having that experience. So we know what that's like. And I'm sure we also know that we try to stop it because we think whether we're embarrassed or, you know, it's just something that we're not in control of.
Well, yeah. Everyone has had these experiences because when I ask people, when I give them examples, they'll say, oh, yeah, I remember that. Mm-hmm. So here's a perfect example. Just take a high school child as an example, and they're on graduation day, and they're going up onto stage, and they're going to get their diploma. Well, this is an exciting event for them. It's not dangerous, but it's a very highly charged event. They're afraid they're going to fall or they're going to embarrass themselves, whatever, and you can ask them, and they'll say, yeah, I was shaking before I went on stage. I was so nervous, I was shaking. That's absolutely common. Take people who are getting married. They're very happy. They're getting married. This is a wonderful day in their life, but they stand up in front of the altar, and either their legs are shaking or their hand is shaking, and so that's an embarrassment because they don't want people to see it. But what's basically happening is the body is simply overcharged. When it gets overcharged with excitement, it discharges that excitement by shaking. Basically. So now you take those same situations and you add a little bit of danger to it. So somebody who's in a car accident, even if it's a mild bumper accident, and they'll get out of the car and they'll say, oh my God, I'm shaking all over. I don't know how to stop myself. We always have those experiences. Your boss is yelling at you. You might find your jaw quivering, or you might find that your hand is shaking, or your knees are shaking and you're nervous. All of those expressions of anxiety where the body begins to tremor, is literally the body saying to us, look, I'm so overstressed, I'm so anxious about this, if I don't tremor, if I don't shake this energy out of me, I'm going to have to contract and hold on to it for a later time. And that's what begins the chronic tension pattern. If we simply allowed ourselves to shake after all of these events, we actually wouldn't develop chronic tension patterns in the body.
Yeah.
So that's how I established these exercises, was actually to give the body back its opportunity to tremor naturally right from within the muscle tissue itself and see, is there anything that the body's still holding on to that it needs to release? And if it does, the tremoring actually resolves it naturally, so it begins to release the muscle tissue. So it's getting the final response that it's always wanted to have after the stressful event, was I need to shake. And if I shake, I'll be fine because I'll discharge this anxiety and my muscle tissue can relax.
Right.
And so that's what the tremors are about, is actually restoring a natural process to the body through these exercises and giving it its final resolution of releasing its tension pattern.
Right. And, you know, the exercises, they start in, I guess, one of our largest muscles, which is in our thighs. But as it moves, it starts to move our pelvis. And that we already spoke about how it, you know, our the fetal position and the, you know, the muscles, it's starting to reach our core. And I loved how you talked about, you know, the difference between Eastern and Western, where the Eastern was all about the hara, or your chi or your prana, and that's all your life force is in your pelvis. Mm-hmm. Where the Western, you know, thinks it's in our head. So when we commit suicide, we shoot our head. But in the Eastern, you know, it used to be the harikara or whatever it, you know, it was that, you know, they would
right
they would get themselves.
I'm working in China now, and I'm working with the earthquake survivors there. And I've gone back numerous times. And one time I went there, we went to the Chinese school for traditional Chinese medicine. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge institute, and it was one of the most, it is the most famous one in Beijing. And when I went there, I had about 11 people from there, and I taught them these exercises to see what their response would be. And they immediately understood, although they had never done these exercises and never had tremoring in this way, they immediately understood that this was opening the blocked channels in the body. So they talked about the hara, or they talked about qi flowing through the meridians, and they were not at all confused by this. Whereas Western medicine doesn't understand it at all, they immediately knew. And what was comical was that they laughed and said, you, as a Westerner, have brought back to the East a new technique of an old method. And so, although they had never done this specific method of getting these tremors, they knew immediately what it was doing, and that it was releasing stuck qi energy through the body and allowing it to flow freely once again. And it began from the center of gravity in the pelvis, or the hara, which they understood immediately that it would have to begin from there and then move through the body from that starting point.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I have to say one of my experiences, and I'm still working it out, but I don't know what I've done to my hip, but it seems to be obviously working something out right now. So while I'm doing the exercises, I notice that, you know, as I because when I, the one exercise where I'm lying down, my legs can go, you know, completely open. And at that point, you know, there is no tremoring because they're completely relaxed and they're open. When I do the movements upwards, that's when the trembling starts. And, you know, I notice because I'm favoring the one hip that, you know, I'm trying to control it, even though the tremors are there. I can feel how I'm trying to control it. And so, you know, it's definitely in our reflection on how, one, we try to control things that occur in our body, and two, about learning how to let go.
That's one of those most difficult things in these exercises when I work with people, certainly from our culture. We are so accustomed to controlling our bodies that one of the most difficult things for them to do is to let go and allow the body to have its own freedom to do something by itself that we don't control, and that the person simply observes what the body is doing, because your body knows exactly how to restore your hips back to their healthiest position. Mm-hmm. And these tremors give it that opportunity to do that, but the fear of allowing that to happen is something that has to be worked through very slowly and over numerous times, because the body doesn't have that fear, but the brain does, and saying, well, I've got to protect it and I have to be careful and safe. And it's true, you do have to do that. But as you're learning, each time you do the exercises, your body will get closer and closer to restoring itself back to its healthiest state that it can possibly return to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel that. Like, I know that that's exactly what's happening. But I wanted to mention it because I'm sure there are people that, you know, that are going through similar things when they try the exercises, or, you know, they notice themselves trying to control things, because I think that's what we do.
Well, it's definitely what we do in our culture. But what I have also discovered is that even though we try to control it and these tremors feel out of control, what I realize, if people do it slow enough and they continue to do it, the body wins. It sort of seems to be more organic than the ego. And the body eventually, in a sense, calms the ego down each time and says, it's okay, I know what I'm doing, you'll be safe, it's no problem. And eventually, even people who are control freaks, if they do these enough times, they'll actually find themselves letting go more and more of control until they can feel very relaxed and secure and allowing the tremors to actually do what they need to do in the body without interfering with them.
Right. So let's talk about, I guess, you know, the more spiritual aspects of this and how, you know, the trauma either allows us to, you know, close off and become numb and, you know, get away from life completely, or sleepwalk, as you say, Or, you know, it allows us to open up and become deeper and more spiritually aware and awoken.
Well, it's true. If you look at trauma in the history of humanity, we have been traumatized ever since humans have been on this planet. And these traumas have not been an impediment to us. They've actually been learning lessons for us. We've actually learned how to live and evolve on the planet because of traumatic events, not despite them. We actually learn from every trauma. So if we take that into a social setting, the same thing is occurring. The more that a person allows themselves to explore what that stressful or traumatic event has done for them, the more they reflect on it, maybe write about it, talk about it, the more they actually integrate that into their lives as a learning lesson. And they actually become somebody different or somebody new from that learning lesson. The more that people try to hold that experience and not process it because they don't like the emotions of it, they don't want to talk about it, they actually lose the ability to use the trauma as a learning experience in life. And what I've discovered from people who have experienced pretty severe traumas in their lives is that they learn really profound lessons about themselves and about life. And here's just one example of it. When you talk to people who have been through potentially a life or death threatening experience like 9/11 or an earthquake or a hurricane where they almost lost their lives or lost the lives of their children or whatever, inevitably they will say, ever since that experience, I live life more richly. I love my children. Family is more important to me now than things or buildings or my house. I just want to be with people I love. And there are many, many people that continue to reflect that back to us, saying, it was the traumatic experience itself that shocked me into awakening into a deeper aliveness than I had ever lived my life before. And that's what I want people to begin to recognize. If we're in stressful or traumatic experiences in our life, not only do we want to and should recover from them, but actually in the recovery process itself, somehow is embedded this shift in consciousness to want to live life at a much richer and deeper level than what we really had prior to that traumatic event. So the traumatic event itself causes some sort of shift in our consciousness if we allow it to. And the shift actually brings us into a deeper aliveness in life rather than the deadness we may have been living before that experience.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even yourself, there was a period where you went into a deep silence within, where you even escaped the world for a little while. But, you know, so it brings us into a deeper solitude, although not, that doesn't mean that we need to necessarily escape, but it brings us into that deeper place. And then also you say that it helps with forgiving.
Well, what happens is, or what my experience was and the experience of many people that I've interviewed and worked with, is that the more severe the event, the more earth-shattering it was, as an example, the deeper you end up going inside and questioning what life is about and who am I and how do I want to live my life, etc. And so the more severe the event, the more severe the search. And so that the severity of that search often leads people into solitude and silence, which is actually quite healthy and good. Mm-hmm. If they get lost in it, is where they could become depressed.
Right.
But if they can go into that and search out their life, and you hear that from many people after traumatic events, I needed to be alone for 2 weeks or 10 days or whatever. I needed to just be in solitude to think about life. Yes, that was perfect. They were going deeply inside to reflect on the experience. And then through that depth of reflection, they came out of it and said, this now is what I want my life to mean to me. This is what has meaning, or this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. They actually, in a sense, re-identified who they were and what life means to them. And so they pulled out something far deeper than they were living prior to the traumatic event. And so I went through that same experience of searching my soul, if you will, and asking what type of life do I want to live for these 80 or 90 years that I'm on this planet? What kind of meaning do I want it to have? what type of endeavors do I want to be involved in? But it was the confrontation of life and death that caused me to ask questions at that depth. Otherwise, I never really had to ask those kind of questions about myself.
Sure. So how do you forgive God for abandoning you?
Well, here's the thing about forgiveness. What I've discovered is that when you go deep enough, you realize that the forgiveness isn't toward God, it isn't towards other people who may have wronged you, it isn't even towards myself. It's about just living the feeling of forgiveness about this is the sadness of life. All of us go through this. All human beings go through some types of tragedy or pain or what seems to be irreconcilable experiences, and we no longer have to forgive other people. We just have to live in the sense of life has this pain in it, and forgiveness is just a natural response to the pain of life or the pain of humanity, not necessarily towards someone or something or some experience. How do you forgive an earthquake? How do you forgive a hurricane? Someone has robbed you. How do you forgive that experience? It's about living into the sadness that life has amazing, joyful experiences, and it also has painful experiences. And that forgiveness is about living into those experiences and not needing to direct them to anyone except to ourselves about this is the way life is. And what you learn to do is realize no one really, I don't have to forgive anybody about anything. I just have to live in an energy of forgiveness for all of humanity, because if you're suffering, I'm suffering. There's no such thing as someone who wins or loses in war. Both groups are suffering in war. And so we have to live in that ethos of forgiveness of humanity for the suffering that we all put ourselves through.
Right. And lastly, let's talk about trauma as a teacher, that it teaches us what love is.
Well, I believe that trauma, when it occurs to us, has the ability to seduce us into looking into it very, very deeply about our humanity. And when we go into that place, there's a profound transformation that has the potential to occur in it. And that profound transformation causes us not only to live an individual life more deeply, but it actually helps me relate to other people who have been through trauma more deeply as well. So that now I'm not only living as an isolated being on this planet, I live with your sadness inside of me as well. I live in connection with you. I live in a deeper spiritual place inside of myself because there's no longer a separation between your suffering and my suffering or your sadness and my sadness. We all, in fact, collectively become one. Now I feel like I'm part of humanity or part of the human race, and that everybody's suffering is somehow something that I participate in and grow from, so that we now all become one being. And it's a great shift in consciousness where we have a greater moral and ethical responsibility to all of us as human beings, so that our goal in life now becomes that no one ever have to go through suffering alone again in the future or in a way that they feel isolated from other human beings, that we're all connected human beings and we're going through this suffering together.
Hmm. Beautiful. Well, David, what a pleasure this has been. I really enjoyed the book. I think as many people that can read it should be reading it, because I think it definitely has some answers and gifts within it that we really need to start to embrace and understand, you know, what has been happening to our bodies.
Yeah, I do believe that I have tried in the book anyways to try to make it as understandable to the layperson as possible. It wasn't written for medical professionals or therapists. And in trying to identify the problem, the exercises are one way of providing a solution to that problem that's accessible to everybody, because all of us can have this response in our bodies. It's not complicated to produce, and everybody, I believe, has the ability to actually heal from even very damaging traumas, and that if we all chose to do that, we would discover that all of humanity is living at a much deeper level of connection to one another, mostly through the sufferings that we've all had to endure as human beings on the planet, rather than despite that. So I really try to bring that into the common everyday life and say, don't be afraid of it anymore. Let's not only just look at it, but let's try to use it to actually deepen our humanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell people how they can get a hold of you.
Okay, they can go to my website, which is traumaprevention.com. And on there, they can find the books or DVDs that I have for sale. I have a lot of free articles on there that talk about trauma and talk about this method. And if they want to contact me directly, they can just click on the link there, which is to my direct email, and I'll make sure that I respond to people.
Nice. Again, David, a great pleasure. I very much enjoyed reading the book, and I very much enjoyed this interview.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it as well.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
All right.